You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've been noticing higher costs for food, furniture, hotels, rental cars, and more, and if you've been seeing something's missing from store shelves, you're not alone. Supplies are down, demand is up for many products. It's been the case for months during the pandemic. And we received some inflation data this week that it was up in December to a 40-year high. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been seeing and feeling inflation in your life? Where has it affected you? How has it affected you? What do you think is causing it? What questions do you have about what is leading to higher prices for a lot of stuff? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Kevin Barr is Professor of Finance and Chief Analyst at the Center for Business and Economic Insight at UW-Stevens Point. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we had inflation tick up earlier this year. There were hopes that it would be fleeting, not stick around. Seems to have stuck around. What are you watching for? How bad is this right now?
Well, in the short term, it's obviously not good. From a longer term, if you want to look and kind of define long-term a little bit, but by the end of 2022, prices will hopefully subside. I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to be tied to supply chain issues, and supply chain issues are, of course, tied to what's going on with COVID. And it's not just COVID in the United States, but it's COVID around the world. If somebody gets sick, can't go to work, or if their children get sick and they have to take care of their children, it takes people out of the workforce. And again, it's not just here, but it's globally. And so as long as COVID hangs on, it's going to affect supply chains.
Yeah, let's stay with the supply chain side of things a little bit in places like China, which, for better or worse, manufacture a lot of stuff, a lot of the stuff we buy. China has a very aggressive lockdown policy, as I understand it, that shuts down factories, maybe even power plants from time to time. Is that the origin story of some of our supply chain problems here?
Absolutely. Or basically just about anybody that we're importing from. I can throw out kind of a quick example, sure, maybe to kind of show how things kind of ripple. But back in 1990, the United States basically produced 37% of the world's semiconductor chips. That 37% has fallen down to about 12%. Most of the stuff that we use is now imported from Southeast Asia. That would include South Korea, Taiwan, China. But if you can't get that semiconductor chip, even though it's a relatively small part of a $30,000 plus vehicle, well, then you're not going to be able to get the vehicle. So that cost goes up. Well, if you can't buy the new vehicle, then you start looking at the used car. Well, then that cost goes up. Used car prices went through the roof last year, up 37%. Well, what if you want to go on vacation? Then you have to rent a car. Well, those prices are going to go up too, because there's a shortage of cars for the rental car companies. So, I mean, that supply chain stuff, it's not only what's going on in the United States, it's global, and it's kind of a rippling effect. It's kind of a snowball effect.
We're talking about inflation right now and how it impacts your life with UW-Stevens Point Professor of Finance Kevin Barr. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something where you've noticed, hey, this costs more than I expected, more than I usually pay for it, whether something small at the grocery store or something big at the furniture store or the car lot? You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your thoughts on what's driving this, your questions for our guest. Again, that's 800-642-1234. I want to get a listen to Fed Chairman Jerome Powell talking earlier this week after being questioned about inflation as part of a confirmation hearing to take a second term. Here's some of what he had to say.
If we see inflation persisting at high levels longer than expected, then we will, if we have to raise interest rates more over time, we will. We will use our tools to get inflation back. And the main reason is this, that to get the kind of very strong labor market we want with high participation, it's going to take a long expansion. We can see that participation is moving only very slowly. And to get a long expansion, we're going to need price stability. Right. And so in a way, high inflation is a severe threat to the achievement of maximum employment and to achieving a long expansion that can give us that.
Let's tackle that point he just made there, Kevin. Inflation maybe raising the risk that we're not going to bring more people back into the labor market. Can you connect the dots for us?
There's really kind of a couple of things going on. I mean, if you continue to have high inflation, that's definitely going to put a damper on any economic growth. And consequently, you're going to have a reduction in any employment opportunities for people then wishing to go back into the labor force. Last year, job openings were basically at record highs in the United States. They were 30% higher than what they were back in 2018. So the Federal Reserve has kind of a long-term goal of or a long-term inflation target of around 2%. So obviously, we were much higher than that at that 7% level to close out last year. So they're very cognizant of the fact of what high inflation can do on the economy. I think one other point that I might throw out, Chairman Powell mentioned as far as the increase in, of interest rates right now are basically bottomed out. We are at record lows. If you go back over the last 50 years, there's only two times that the Federal Reserve has pushed interest rates down to their current level, which is basically between 0 and 0.25% for very short-term interest rates. That happened after the financial crisis, and it happened after COVID. So the rate levels we have now, that's not normal. That is abnormal. If you go back a couple of years ago, interest rates were at 2%. So interest rate increases, they are very, very likely this year. But even if they happen to, say, push short-term rates to 1% to 1.5%, that is still relatively very low in the United States.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Say, I think your guest is right. You know, even the small chips now we have to depend upon it globally. And when we made that shift probably 20, 30 years ago, everything's great globally as long as it's working well. But if it doesn't work well or we have a pandemic and have to depend upon other countries, that's where we're at. And I frankly think a lot of people forgot about the Phillips curve about 20 years ago, but it's back again on interest rates and inflation. So that's just my comments. So,
Bob, thanks for calling. Bob's first comment, Kevin, there are rewards to a globalized economy when things work. As Bob was saying, things can work pretty well. The stuff gets cheaper a lot of the time as people use their, I guess, competitive local advantage. When things don't work, it gets disrupted. It can take a lot longer to untangle.
Bob is absolutely correct. And there's a couple of things behind that. I mean, number one, supply chains over the last 20, 30 years, you know, with globalization, they've really become kind of interconnected, or should say maybe intertwined between countries. And I mean, U.S. corporations made the decision to do that. And the objective is to basically, in a lot of cases, minimize your cost. Well, as Bob pointed out, that's great if there's no sort of bumps in the supply chain. But the problem that you get, if there is a bump in the supply chain, well, then what do? You just don't put up a semiconductor plant overnight. And that's kind of one of the problems with this supply chain stuff for inflation. Well, can it be fixed? Well, yeah, sort of, but it's not going to change overnight. So I think Bob is spot on with his comments.
And Bob mentioned the Phillips curve. I'll admit, I just quick refresh myself on that online. And that's the idea that more employment leads to more inflation, and there's a relationship between the two. Is this the thinking? I mean, that's kind of what the Fed used to do, right? If employment got too hot, they would worry about inflation.
Well, that's true, although I think in what's gone on in the COVID, you've got a little something different going on. If you look at U.S. employment, we peaked at about 152 million before COVID, and then we lost about 22 million jobs in 2 months. So back in April 2020, that was down to 130 million. Employment's come back to about 149 million, which is obviously good, but we're still not at the employment levels that we were at pre-COVID. So, okay, if we're not at the employment levels that we were at pre-COVID, why is inflation so bad? Well, then you enter the supply chain problems, number one, and also energy costs have gone through the roof. And just about everything that you buy is delivered by a truck. So last year, gas prices were up 50%. Energy prices overall were up 30%. And we definitely could discuss that a little bit more, but that kind of, you know, again, it kind of filters through everything. So yeah, the increase in employment, that's definitely, I mean, we've had a strong comeback, economy's been strong, but with these supply chain issues, inflation's really increased significantly.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. John is on the line in Sturgeon Bay. John, hi.
Hi. Calling to bring up another aspect to this conversation. And, you know, COVID certainly makes sense. But in the Wall Street Journal, there was a recent article, January 11th, and it says the title is "A Big Reason for Rising Prices is the Weather." And I know you mentioned some energy prices and like in Texas, you know, the big freeze and affect their production and delivery of energy. And then the price went way up because things got frozen. And then there's been like soybeans, there's been drought and fires and floods and
I gotcha. John, I get the point. We're coming up on a break, but Kevin, extreme weather events driving the cost of fuel and energy, John says, and that trickles elsewhere.
Again, I think John is absolutely right. I think one of the novel things with this increase in inflation is we're kind of just discussing the subject. You just can't point to one thing as the cause of the inflation. A number of things have contributed to it.
Thanks for that call, John. We're talking to Kevin Barr, finance professor, chief analyst for the Center for Business and Economic Insight at UW-Stevens Point. We're talking about the high inflation data that just came out this week, drawing some connections to what's happening with the pandemic, looking how it fits into the bigger economic picture. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a culprit you'd want to point toward for high inflation, or if you want to tell us how it's affecting you in your personal finances, at your workplace, 800-642-1234. Has it changed the way you spend money? Have you changed what you're going to buy? And have your habits changed in general? Maybe traveling less, so you're looking for other things to spend that money on and finding lots of people are looking for the same stuff. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about inflation with UW-Stevens Point's Kevin Barr, professor of finance. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions or your experiences firsthand with inflation. That's 800-642-1234. Kevin, before we go back to our callers, I want to look at another culprit that some point to, and that's federal spending, some big COVID relief spending in 2020. At the beginning of last year, we had a new package, an infrastructure bill passed. I don't know how much of that money's actually hit the streets yet. Is there a role for a lot of federal government spending driving up the supply of money in people's pockets, their demand for stuff, and then prices going up?
In my opinion, that certainly would not be the primary culprit. I mean, if you look at where we were back in April 2020, the unemployment rate hit 14.7%. We lost over 20 million jobs in 2 months. So money was spent back in 2020. By the end of the year, and the unemployment rate had gone from 14.7% down to about 6.7%. So, I mean, that's nice improvement. But again, there was more to be done. So there was more spending the following year in 2021. And that did lower the unemployment rate down to 3.9% at the end of the year. Now, that's true, but you still had 3 million fewer people employed at the end of 2021 compared to what you had pre-COVID. So, yes, there was government spending. Yes, it was a very quick turnaround to get people back into jobs, but it still didn't match the level of employment that basically happened pre-COVID. So, the supply chain issues are really kind of the number one driver of this. And again, energy costs, with that going up the way it, a 50% increase in gas prices, that trickles through everything that you buy.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Richland Center. Mike, hi.
Hi. I have a question. It seems that the president often gets blamed for bad economics, and I'm curious, is the president to blame? Should he be doing something, or should he be not doing something to help this out?
Mike, good question. Kevin, what is in a president's bag of tricks, a toolkit to try to deal with inflation?
Mike, I think that is an excellent question. So I'll just make a general comment, not geared in any way toward any party, but typically I think presidents get too much of the credit when things go right and too much of the blame when things go wrong. If you look at interest rates, the Federal Reserve primarily controls interest rates in this country. And obviously, if you move interest rates, that can influence demand. But the Federal Reserve acts theoretically as an independent body. So if you look back through history and how things have gone with the economy, whether it's 1990 or 1980, typically there's way too much blame when things go wrong and too much credit when things go right. As far as what the president can do, again, the president can basically use fiscal policy. That was done through multiple rounds. Trump did it. Biden did it. And from that angle, you can control that part of the economy. You really can't control interest rates, and you can't do much with the supply chain. The supply chain issues, there's very little that the president can do with the supply chain issues in the short run.
Thanks for that call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. Talking about inflation with Kevin Barr from UW-Stevens Point. Let's go next to Tim in Sauk City. Tim, hi.
Thank you, guys. You haven't discussed this that I've heard. A major factor here is the oil companies have transitioned in the last 5 years. Congress allowed the American oil to be sold internationally. Went under the international market. That had all changed in the 70s when we had the long oil lines. You know, the government restricted the oil to be sold that was produced in the United States could only be sold in the United States. And we've had a high production of oil in the country. So the oil companies wanted to get the highest price that they could. And so they changed the legislation. And now they're getting paid off, and they're doing in the president by doing that. The 50% increase in oil prices is due to the oil companies getting a payoff because they bought the politicians.
Tim, thanks for the call. Kevin, is there something to that? American oil being sold overseas, if it stayed here, the prices might come down?
To a point, yes. And let me kind of maybe try to explain this a little bit more. Mm-hmm. If you look at the overall global demand for oil or what's going on with oil prices, it's basically gone nuts globally. U.S. oil production, as was just pointed out, was at a record high before COVID hit, and then it dropped about 20% after COVID. And with that drop in production, typically comes a drop in supply. And so typically what happens when the economy is going really, really good, oil production is ramped up, oil is sold by U.S. companies globally. But then when the economy contracts, inventories are cut back significantly. As I mentioned, U.S. oil production declined about 20% back in 2020. And then you get inventories at really low level. And then when the economy starts going kind of roaring back, then typically what happens is there's a mismatch between what is demanded and what is supplied, and prices go through the roof. In the United States, the price per barrel went from about $16 to $80. Overseas, it went from about $9 to about $80. Now that's backed off a little bit lately as production is started to kind of been ramped up. But typically there's a lag effect, and that happened in 2009, and it's basically happened again now. But as the caller pointed out, I mean, U.S. oil production is at a record high before COVID hit.
Tim, thanks for the call. We had a listener email, and I've seen this from some Democratic senators as well, an accusation that some of the price increases are corporate profit taking. They know there's some more money out there from federal relief, and they're looking to cash in. What do you think of those claims?
Corporate profits are 30% higher now than what they were back in 2018. So certainly that doesn't apply to every company. That's generally what has happened. So certainly in some cases that although costs have gone up to corporations, the prices that consumers are paying has gone up by more than the cost increase to corporations. corporations. And again, the number that I'm throwing out there is basically tracked by the Federal Reserve.
And just our last minute and a half or so, what are you watching for over the next couple months to see if inflation has peaked and we'll start dialing down again?
Well, I think you got a couple things here, but I think number one is going to be that supply chain issue. If you can get COVID under control worldwide, you get rid of any labor interruptions, you get supply chains back on track, and that's going to do an awful lot to kind of lessen any problems with inflation. In addition to that, you'll also see a ramp up again a little bit in interest rates. Again, they're still going to be historically relatively low, but that will temper demand a little bit. And again, I think all this stuff, it's just going to smooth out a little bit. You won't have the rapid increases in economic growth. That's going to smooth out. You won't have the rapid increases in employment growth. That's going to smooth out. So by the end of this year, the Federal Reserve, take it for what it's worth, it's a forecast, but they hope inflation will be under 3% by the end of the year.
You use the phrase, if we can get COVID under control worldwide. That's one of the biggest ifs I've ever heard. There's a lot of ways this could go.
Well, you know, if you go back about a year ago, I think for the most part, there was a lot of expectation that, you know, when you went back to the grocery store, you weren't going to have to worry about getting toilet paper or something else anymore. And then you had the resurgence of COVID at the end of the year. And it's sort of like, well, now we're kind of going back to the way things were kind of in April and May 2020.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you very much for the opportunity. And thanks to all our callers for calling in.
That's Kevin Barr, professor of finance and chief analyst at the Center for Business and Economic Insight at UW-Stevens Point. We talked to him today about new inflation numbers out this week. In December, we hit a level not seen in the U.S. for about 40 years. Coming up Monday on Central Time, American drivers have a speeding addiction. We'll hear the case is going to take some personal changes and design updates to fix it. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll check out yesterday's Supreme Court rulings on President Biden's vaccine mandates, the political reactions, and what comes next. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we're looking for your cooking plans for 2022. Let us know what you want to learn and try in the kitchen or on the grill. First, large private businesses will not have to require workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19 or be subjected to weekly tests. In a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down President Biden's vaccine mandate for employers. It would have affected businesses with 100 or more employees. It's about 84 million people involved. It also would have required unvaccinated workers to wear masks indoors at the office. But in a separate 5-4 ruling, justices upheld the vaccine requirement for healthcare workers in facilities that get federal funding. Chief Justice John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh joined the court's three liberals in that decision. The rulings come as the Omicron variant continues to spread rapidly across the country. According to Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. is reporting an average of 786,000 new infections per day over the last week. The Department of Health and Human Services says hospitalizations are up 27% over that same span. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Supreme Court decisions? Do you support vaccine mandates or not at the federal level, or should it be states, local governments, or maybe individual businesses that should make these decisions? Would you have been affected by the mandate for businesses or the one for healthcare workers? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He specializes in public law, judicial process, and American politics. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Any surprises here, Charlie, in this pair of rulings?
Yeah, I don't think so. because of the tilt that we've seen over the last few years towards a more conservative court, this really sort of fits in with their approach to administrative law and the application of discretion that's given to agencies like OSHA and the Department of Labor. So just because of the membership of the court, it doesn't seem unusual. I will say that some of their justifications for their ruling, I think, are a little brief and need some explication. And I think that's what the dissenters, in particular, in the National Federation of Independent Businesses case, the one that eliminated the mandate, or at least put a stay on the mandate, that's what they were really saying about the per curiam opinion here, was that it didn't really flesh out many of the reasons why the mandate wouldn't be permissible in this particular circumstance.
I want to read a couple snippets from the majority opinion, unsigned, but as you alluded, the six conservative, or generally described as conservative, justices voted to put that stay on that mandate. Here's a quote or two. Although Congress has indisputably given OSHA the power to regulate occupational dangers, it has not given that agency the power to regulate public health more broadly. And it went on, requiring the vaccination of 84 million Americans selected simply because they work for employers with more than 100 employees certainly falls in the latter category, a category of, I think, overreach and arbitrariness they were arguing. Is there something to that argument, that this goes beyond OSHA's power as authorized by Congress, and it unfairly distinguishes one kind of employee from another?
Well, this is probably one of the biggest debates within administrative law, and this is not a topic that usually lights everybody's world on fire to talk about these kinds of issues, sort of deep in the weeds of bureaucracy. But it's about what kind of discretion that agencies get, and when can they fill in the blanks of ambiguous legislation. So really what you saw was an argument here between the majority and the minority justices about how much latitude do you give the agency to create these kinds of rules and regulations when Congress isn't really specific. And so from the dissenter's point of view, these sort of emergency orders are exactly the kind of thing that Congress would expect OSHA to do, because no one can predict the future. When you offer these kinds of powers to an agency, what you're saying to them is, we're going to defer to you and your expertise to tell us when the federal government has to step in and help to mitigate these kinds of issues. And what the majority is saying is, well, if we do that, if we allow this kind of interpretation of vague, ambiguous phrases in the legislation, then in essence, what happens is OSHA substitutes itself for Congress. And Congress may have never intended for this kind of regulatory scheme to be created. And so that's sort of the pull and the tug of this debate. Both have merit. Both sides have merit here, because you don't want an agency to just be creating out of whole cloth their own perceptions about what the law should be. But at the same time, and this really comes through in Breyer's opinion, this is exactly the kind of thing you would expect to happen from OSHA. If you see, as we did at the outset of the pandemic, so meatpacking industry and the like, where you saw massive outbreaks and deaths caused by COVID, that this is the kind of remedy that we would expect OSHA to implement to make all workers, not just those in specific industries, safe.
From that minority ruling in this particular case, here's a quote. This ruling, quote, undercuts the capacity of the responsible federal officials acting well within the scope of their authority to protect American workers from grave danger. And that's the argument from the three liberal justices here. Yes, it may not be specifically outlined in Congress, the idea of a vaccine requirement from OSHA. It fits into OSHA's job, I guess, they say.
That's exactly right. And what they're trying to point out to the majority is a certain hypocrisy in their argument. So again, there is a valid argument to be made that agencies shouldn't be able to make up regulations that Congress never intended. That is superseding the authority of the legislative branch. But when the court steps in and says, no, the agency got it wrong, we got it right, they're doing the same thing. They're interposing their own view about how we should interpret ambiguous phrases in law and how they should be applied by the agencies in the executive branch. So what they're trying to do is kind of peel back a little bit of this hypocrisy, kind of, you know, pull back the curtain on the Wizard of Oz on the majority here, because they want to show that we have to defer whenever possible to what Congress may have intended, and to allow a little latitude to these agencies to make sure they're protecting the public in these kinds of circumstances.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert College, looking at this week's U.S. Supreme Court rulings, blocking one vaccine mandate affecting employers from the Biden administration, the other Biden administration mandate for healthcare workers at places that get federal money, that was allowed to stand. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about either or both of those decisions. Let's bring on a caller now. Scott is with us in Appleton. Scott, hi.
Hey, how you doing? You know, I find great irony, and it doesn't matter to me, liberal or conservative, that they're allowing the protection of the people that protect us once we get sick. Yet the masses aren't directed. I think we're in the crisis mode. I think we're going to be dealing with this for years and years. And who knows, the next variant, who knows what that could do. But I think it's just a shame that we had an opportunity to put a little heat on those that are unvaccinated. I know that's not politically correct. I don't care because I look at the good of the whole rather than a handful of people that are digging their heels in.
Scott, thanks for the call. Charlie, Scott thinks it's okay for OSHA to use this to pressure the unvaccinated to get vaccinated. Is that it for the benefit, he says, of our overall healthcare system and healthcare workers? Is that something that justice has considered here?
I think that's one of the things that irked the dissent here. And there are two comments to be made about that. One, I think, is the point that this technically wasn't a vaccine mandate.
Right.
I mean, certainly that was going to be very likely the easiest way for compliance by businesses. But there was an opportunity where testing and masking could be used in lieu of vaccinations if there was objections by singular employees or by the company itself. But the other issue that was raised by the dissent was that in order to grant a stay, there are typically four elements that have to be met in order to grant the stay. That is to stop the enforcement of the particular rule or regulation. And the last one is, will the public interest be served if a stay is granted? And what Breyer and the others in the minority were arguing is, how could we say that the public interest is being served if we're going to allow unvaccinated people to avoid any mitigation of the potential of infecting other people? And so I think that sort of gels with what Scott was trying to argue here, is that there's a greater good, a community good, that the mandate was trying to create that the court seemed to overlook in some of its analysis.
Scott, thanks for the call. We're looking at the fallout from yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court rulings on President Biden's vaccine mandates with Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did the court get it right or wrong on either of both of the rulings? One for larger employers, which the court put a stay on, says the government can't enforce that. One for healthcare workers at facilities that get federal dollars. The court said, yeah, that one can go ahead. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the Biden administration's vaccine mandates in a 6-3 decision along ideological lines. Justices put a stay on the requirement for private businesses with at least 100 employees, but in a 5-4 ruling, they upheld the mandate for healthcare workers at facilities that get federal funding. Charlie Jacobs stays with us, professor of political science at St. Norbert College, who studies the Supreme Court. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to those rulings, what they mean for you, if anything, or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Cyril is with us in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Regarding the healthcare decision, that was one of the more rational decisions that the Supreme Court has made of late, although the 5-4 split is not encouraging. Regarding the business mandate, I think when President Biden instituted that mandate, he specified that the mandate was specifically to businesses with 100 or more employees, which gives me the idea that he was considering giving the small business environment a break from this mandate, and that it would be specifically the larger presumably companies who would be able to afford such a thing.
Got it. Cyril, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about that. Why larger employees employers with over 100 employees, Charlie, before we move on to the healthcare worker part of this?
So one of the issue there has to do with the Supreme Court's understanding of what kind of business enterprise impacts interstate commerce, because Congress has the authority to regulate interstate commerce. And the notion is that larger businesses are going to have a larger impact and as a result are able to be regulated by Congress rather than businesses that are local and their business is primarily, if not exclusively, intrastate commerce. So while I don't disagree with Cyril that there might have been an intention that some smaller businesses are going to have a more difficult time conducting testing, providing masks, or requiring their employees to get the vaccine. At the same time, it has something to do with sort of the overarching doctrine of the Supreme Court and the application of federal authority over states and local businesses.
Thanks for that call, Cyril, at 800-642-1234. And Charlie, Cyril's first comment gets us to the other lawsuit, the one regarding healthcare workers at facilities, again, that get federal money. 5-4 decision upholding that. What did you see in the arguments on both sides?
The distinction I see between these two cases is that the court found in the first case regarding the businesses and the application there that the original statute from Congress, what you call the Organic Act, was too vague to be able to extend the powers to that kind of regulatory control. But what the court was saying in the case regarding the healthcare workers was that because of the statutes that deal with the provision of Medicare and Medicaid dollars to the states and the hospitals, that there is a scheme of regulatory care that needs to be met. And this is almost sort of a foundational element. If you don't have healthcare workers to provide the services required by Medicare and Medicaid, the entire system might collapse. So I think that what convinced at least a couple of more justices to pull towards supporting this particular mandate was that it fit more closely in with what Congress intended the program to do. The OSHA regulation, they argued, did not because it was too intrusive into the business practices for these companies.
Now, the minority wrote here, this is Justice Alito, a group of four conservative justices in the minority, writing, quote, "I do not think that the federal government is likely to be able to show that Congress has authorized the unprecedented step of compelling over 10 million healthcare workers to be vaccinated on pain of being fired," end quote. What do you think of that argument? Again, like the OSHA decision saying, yeah, this exceeds what Congress really authorizes here.
So embedded in these arguments that are going on here in both of these decisions is a much broader discussion that the court is having and, you know, political ideologies in the United States are having about the role and expanse of the federal government. So we've all heard the government's gotten too big or the era of big government is here or over. That was from the Clinton administration. And part of what you're seeing here is an attempt by the more conservative members of the court to rein in the ability of agencies to regulate. And what Alito is saying there is you can't act as a regulatory agency unless Congress specifically gave you the power. And that may sound reasonable, but the problem is that as we watch our Congress today fight over the smallest and largest kinds of issues, to expect that Congress is going to be able to draft a very large piece of legislation and be so specific that it covers every potential eventuality is unlikely. That's why discretion is often permitted in the way in which agencies create these rules. Because if we didn't give them this discretion, Congress, A, would have to be very specific and become very collegial very quickly, or the ability to regulate would almost be eliminated.
Let's go back to our callers. Scott is with us in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Scott?
Well, on the case of the employers that, you know, with 100 or more employees, I think that was probably pretty good. You know, when you get more than 100, you're getting into the corporations, you know, multi-state kind of groups. They're going to shift stuff around anyway, like, I mean, throughout all the regulations so they can, you know, go from state to state and do their thing that they usually do, maximize profit, and that's good. But And then plus, you know, I think, you know, as far as government goes, it's not really a the government's job to protect us, you know, for everything either. There's got to be some kind of, you know, accountability. So you'd think even just some of these big companies would be like, hey, we're big and we can do this ourselves without the government, and we can, you know, slow spread, stop spread, what have you, you know.
Scott, thanks for the call. Scott's saying we can leave it to big companies to figure out what works for them for protecting health at the workplace.
And I think Scott may be onto something there, that, you know, we have to rely on each other to be able to do what's right for the community. And we don't always have to rely on government. I think in some circumstances, some companies and corporations were looking for cover, and the government was going to give them that cover instead of having to make the decision on their own and maybe take the slings and arrows from their local communities or their employees or their shareholders, for that matter, that if they said, well, the government is making us do this, that they had a built-in excuse for why they were doing it. So I think that there is something to be said for that as well, that that's the kind of responsibility that we expect from government, is that they will lead because they have the resources to be able to do the research to tell us exactly what the most prudent approach is. Now, of course, there are those who are going to say, you know, we have to expect in different areas of the country with different kinds of businesses and industries with different imperatives that they should be able to figure out their own scheme to solve these problems on their own. So this is a debate that is central to American politics and has been for more than 200 years. And just because this is a once in a generation pandemic doesn't mean that these kinds of ideological issues are going to evaporate.
Scott, thanks for that call. Angela joins us now in Baraboo. Angela, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call. It's less about the logic of the Supreme Court decision and more about the emotional aspect of some of the healthcare workers who are avoiding vaccination. I work in healthcare. My husband and I both had COVID. I nearly lost him. And I am vaccinated, and so is he. But I do also understand, because I have worked in hospitals for 30 years now, that there comes a time with each new disease. As a healthcare worker, you're constantly being tested for something. Once a year, you have to get TB, you have to get flu, you have to get this, you have to get that. And after so many years of doing it, you really feel like, wait a minute, this is my body. This is my biology. You know, I don't belong to anybody but myself. And so while I do vehemently encourage people to get vaccinated, because while you still might get sick, it will save your life. I do believe this. I can also understand why some healthcare workers are going, wait a minute, you know, no, this is one more thing and I don't want to.
Angela, thanks a lot for that call. Charlie, a nuanced thoughts there about our personal sovereignty over our bodies versus our own personal health and our, I guess, ability to protect other people's health.
And, you know, it goes back to the comment I made earlier about those four elements about whether or not a stay is going to be granted. The second of those is, will the party bringing the case suffer some sort of irreparable harm if there isn't a stay? And that, I think, is exactly what Angela is bringing up. If you have to get the vaccine, for some people, that's irreparable harm. And there's no way to undo that vaccination. And I think that's what the majority was looking at in this particular case. Are there other methods where we can avoid the transmission of this disease without forcing so many people, having this great economic and social impact? Are there other ways which we can accommodate these people? And I think that's in part what led them to the decision that they made.
Angela, thanks for the call. Charlie, you've emphasized this is a stay. Is there still court action going on, especially on the employer mandate?
Yeah, they can still bring a case and it can have a full review before the court to determine whether or not the stay takes in place and that they overturn the rule or regulation, or they lift the stay and allow it to continue. But the court has great discretion about whether or not they're going to hear a case in full. So we'll see whether or not the court offers that in the future. You need four votes, four of nine justices. You had six in the majority here. So there's a chance that this will not come to the court again.
Charlie, thanks as always for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That's Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We talked to him today about the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings on a pair of vaccine mandates from the Biden administration, striking down effectively a requirement for large private businesses, upholding a similar order for certain healthcare workers. coming up after the news. It's Food Friday. We'll talk about cooking resolutions or plans or ideas for the new year. You can get started right now. Let us know what you are planning to try to change up over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.